Thanks very much, Martin, for that very warm introduction. And it certainly is good to be with CEDA again today. The state of the nation is, I think, a very apt description of the important need to take a stock take, if you like, of our economy, the pressures and the challenges that are over the horizon. I think it is important that we, even given all of our immediate challenges, take the time to think about the priorities for the future. I'm certainly of the view, and the government is most certainly of the view, that we should never take our eye off the long term, however daunting all of the immediate challenges are. And of course, the immediate challenges are there for everybody to see. Certainly, the Australian economy has not been exposed to this degree of international turmoil since the 1930s. And of course, it is only natural in this environment that the public would focus more understandably on the here and now and the immediate outlook. I do want to talk a bit about that today. I do want to talk about the government's response, but I also want to focus on the long-term challenges that this economy faces, the long-term reforms that are absolutely necessary to make sure that when the economy recovers globally, that we maximise all of the opportunities that flow from that. So certainly I do want to emphasise that despite all of those challenges that we face at the moment, this government has and is very determined about the long-term reform agenda. But before I do that, I do want to talk a little bit about the reason why Australia is doing much better than many other advanced economies. I want to talk a bit about why we still have a very substantial jobs challenge ahead of us, and of course, what the government is doing about that. Now, that's a lot of ground, but I'll attempt to move through it as succinctly as I can. Now, if we're talking about the here and now and the current challenges, I think there are two main objectives that the government is focusing on, given that we have this synchronised global recession. The very first one, the most fundamental thing that we are doing, is we are trying to support our people by supporting jobs. And of course, what we are also trying to do as we do that, we are trying to position this country to benefit more out of that global recovery than many other nations, to maximise the opportunities of and that flow from a global recovery. What I want to talk about first is stimulus. Now, I think we all know from the March national accounts that the government's efforts to stimulate the economy and, of course, the efforts of the community working with us, particularly, I might emphasise here, the business community, have allowed this country to outperform all other advanced economies. So I think we should take some heart from the combination of strong government policy action and the national unity and purpose that has gone with it to give us lower debt, lower deficits and stronger growth than comparable countries. So at a time when other advanced economies are going backwards, Australia is going forward. So we grew by 0.4% in the March quarter, whereas the G7 economies collectively contracted by 2.1%. Think about that for a moment. The G7 economies collectively contracted by 2.1% over the same period. Now, of course, there are a range of reasons for this, and I'll just run through a few of them quickly. There's the strength of our banking system. There's the quality of our regulators, our strong balance sheet, our strong fiscal position, and of course our geographical position on the doorstep of the world's most dynamic region. But of course there is also one other important factor, and that is that our stimulus is world's best practice. We are doing more to support jobs and stimulate key sectors of the economy than many other countries, and we're doing it in a more effective way. And I think it's also important to remember that that stimulus is still flowing. The cash payments that have done so much to prop up demand were only phase one of our economic stimulus. And of course, you are all familiar with Stage 2, which is basically the shovel-ready projects, the investments in schools and homes and energy efficiency and social housing that are going on around the country. Something like 35,000 projects, shovel-ready projects, which are kicking off running through the rest of this year and into the year after. And of course, there is Phase 3 of economic stimulus, which was announced in the budget, which is essentially the commitment to the critical economic infrastructure, the rail, the port, the broadband, which is also to flow through as we go through the years ahead. Now, as you know, there's been a fair bit of controversy about the fact that the government has had to borrow, firstly, to cover a revenue collapse of $210 billion over the Ford estimates. A $210 billion collapse in revenues caused by the global recession. And of course, also, we have had to support our economic stimulus. And we have engaged in borrowing to do that because that is entirely the responsible thing to do in these circumstances, to cover a revenue collapse and to cover investment in critical nation-building infrastructure. Now, sensible commentators and many in our community understand the fact that Australia has had the room to do this, the capacity to do it, because we do have low levels of public debt, low levels of deficit compared with the rest of the world. And, of course, this was underscored yet again by IMF analysis released just last Tuesday, because it's important to acknowledge that when you make these investments, they do deliver a return to the country over time. And, of course, what we should acknowledge also this morning is what would be the human costs of not engaging in that borrowing. What would be the human costs? Well, the human cost of not putting in place that responsible borrowing would be fewer jobs, it's as simple as that, less people employed, a higher cost to the nation. And that is why I said in the beginning of my remarks that our number one priority has been to support employment. That has underpinned our successful stimulus strategy from day one. We are absolutely committed to support employment now and to build the economy and to build the economy for future generations by supporting not just employment now, but fundamental investment in the skills and capacities of our people. Our Treasury estimates that our economic stimulus will support an extra 210,000 jobs over the period ahead. That's 210,000 Australians and their families who would otherwise be without work were it not for government action. The stimulus packages are expected to reduce the forecast peak in the unemployment rate by 1.5 percentage points, from 10% to 8.5%. Now, the political debates about stimulating the economy to support jobs too often fail to factor in, as I said before, the human and financial costs of unemployment. Just consider these facts, which are from Treasury estimates of our economic stimulus. Total employee incomes over the next decade will be around $100 billion higher as a result of stimulus. These higher incomes translate into additional personal income tax of around $23 billion over the next decade. The number of long-term unemployed will average around 80,000 less. That is 80,000 less longer-term unemployed. And expenditure on unemployment benefits will be nearly $4 billion lower over 4 years. Now, of course, in saying all these things and in saying that our stimulus has been successful, we have to understand that Australia still faces, despite all of this, a really substantial employment challenge as the global recession continues to batter our people and our businesses. And, of course, one of the difficulties in giving speeches like this and talking about recovery is that we do know full well that it remains the fact that for hundreds of thousands of Australians, there is still a risk of losing their jobs because of the global recession before it has run its full course. which is why the government has been so emphatic about having phase one, phase two, and phase three of our economic stimulus. And that's why I guess our optimism about the recent encouraging signs in our economy must always be tempered by our understanding that there is a rocky road ahead. And that is, of course, why we don't wish to get bogged down into technical debates about recessions. The time is far better spent implementing labour market initiatives to meet the employment challenge in our economy, because all of these initiatives are needed to alleviate the immediate pressures on those who are affected by the downturn in economic growth. And of course, what we need to do is to focus particularly on those who have been adversely affected by all of these developments. We need to keep a focus on skills and productivity that can secure long-term economic growth. So the government's jobs and training compact that we've put in place does precisely that. Worth $1.5 billion over 5 years, it will certainly be assisting those Australians whose job prospects have been adversely affected by the global recession. It will invest in the education and training of young Australians, will invest in retrenched workers and local communities to assist them to get back to work, to add to their skills, and of course to learn new skills required to obtain jobs as the labour market recovers. The compact brings the total number of additional training places for job seekers to 81,000 and the total number of productivity training places being offered by this government to something like 710,000 at a cost of over $2 billion. So our approach is to do all we can to keep people in work and to train those people who, through no fault of their own, lose their jobs to the ravages of this global recession. And of course, if this global recession has taught us anything, it's that no Australian is immune from the international conditions we operate in. But also that fact reinforces, particularly in the government's thinking, and I know it's in the thinking of the business community, it reinforces the urgency of facing up to the fact that we have to put in place the long-term policy settings as well, over the horizon and beyond. That we can't lose sight of dealing with the demographic, technological and societal shifts we need to harness and to turn to our advantage over the longer term. Now, of course, everything we know about economic growth in advanced economies over the past century tells us there has been a clear shift towards knowledge-based goods and services. And of course, today, the distinguishing feature that sets advanced economies apart is their emphasis on the knowledge economy. So increasingly, it's the skills and knowledge of our population, our human capital, if you like, is on which our future fortune rests. So to adapt to these global conditions successfully, we do need workers with the skills and education to enable them to seize economic opportunities as they arise. And of course, we do need robust institutions and quality infrastructure to boost productivity. In short, what we have to do is to put in place the settings for a modern, competitive and productive economy. And there are three fundamental challenges we must face as we do this. The first one is, of course, the looming demographic transition facing the economy as a generation of older workers starts to retire. And as a baby boomer, and many in this room are like me, you know, we are about to move through the system, posing very big challenges for advanced economies and particularly for ours. And of course, we also need to adapt to the shift in economic weight towards China, India and other emerging economies, particularly in our region. And of course, there are the economic and social changes that will flow from climate change and of course our responses to that. So all of these factors will underpin and inform policy making in the years ahead, well beyond the current economic downturn. Building a new economy will entail a revitalised and broadened reform agenda, one that is every bit as ambitious as the 1980s and the 1990s. This is the task that we all face, not just the government, but the country as a whole. We simply can't rely on global economic conditions to be good in the future. We can't rely on a never-ending mining boom. What we have to do is to make sure that we get our settings right, so that we maximise our opportunities that flow from what's occurring elsewhere in the world. We just simply no longer have the luxury of coasting along while a booming global economy underwrites continuing rises in living standards in this country. That is certainly not guaranteed. And that is why we do need a bold plan for the long-term economic future of the nation. It is now more important than ever. And that's why I want to talk about that in my remaining remarks, because it brings me to the government's plans, particularly for nation-building infrastructure and also for the education revolution. These are the twin pillars which bring together the physical and human capital we need to build a generation of prosperity, one that lifts productivity and expands opportunity. We believe that sustained investment in Australia's economic infrastructure and reform of infrastructure markets are critical to boosting national productivity. Now, before the global economic downturn, capacity constraints and infrastructure bottlenecks in some of Australia's key export supply chains were shackling our economy. We must address these infrastructure gaps now, and now does provide an opportunity to do it. But it's just not the infrastructure gaps, it's the reform to planning and regulation. It's improving logistics, it's improving chain of command and coordination, and it's better using infrastructure through appropriate pricing. All of these things have important roles to play in ensuring that we avoid the re-emergence of these problems when global growth returns. And of course, the infrastructure measures delivered in the budget do represent a critical investment in the drivers of Australia's long-term economic growth. The budget delivered a $22 billion investment in infrastructure, which will support around 15,000 jobs each year, peaking at around 18,000 jobs in 2011-12. And of course, that includes $8.5 billion in investment in critical economic infrastructure in the road, the rail, and the port. And of course, what this means is that investment, when global recovery takes hold, it means our ports won't be straining or our rail networks won't be as poor, and certainly our roads won't be as clogged. And that's before we get to national broadband, NBN, a super fast broadband network we are building, which will also transform the Australian economy and allow us to take advantage of the global recovery and also accommodate that shift to knowledge-based industries. Now, of course, this network will be built in partnership with the private sector. It will be the single largest nation-building infrastructure project in our history, one that has the potential to substantially boost productivity in our economy, and for that to flow through from small business through to large business and through to all of our other key objectives that we are outlining for reform. Now, of course, the other pillar of recovery is our education revolution. On top of the training initiatives I covered earlier, and despite the difficult economic times, the government has not backed away from our education revolution or the vision outlined in the Bradley Review of higher education. We are now undertaking the most substantial reforms of the higher education system in the last 20 years, investing $2.1 billion in higher education over 5 years, plus funding from the Education Investment Fund to build the productive and skilled workforce of tomorrow. And this, of course, is one of the issues which is very close to my heart, and that is the need to make better use of the talents and toil of all of our people, bringing more Australians along with us as we create wealth and raise living standards. Now, with this in mind, we're investing $491 million to uncap the number of public university places from 2012, allowing universities to offer a place to all eligible students. This will see an extra 50,000 students commence studies over the next 4 years. And, of course, a new financial loading will be provided to reward institutions that attract and retain low socioeconomic status students. So that's part and parcel of the education revolution. And along with our investment in infrastructure are the twin pillars that we are putting in place, particularly through the recent budget and the budget before that. Now, along with these investments in human and physical capital, we also know there are other reforms that we need to put in place which will shape the economic performance of the Australian economy into the future. And, of course, one of those is the reform of Commonwealth-state relations. It's a key factor in our ability to reform so many areas of our economy. And if you've been watching the meetings of COAG over the last 12 to 18 months, there has been a fundamental reform agenda ranging right across a whole host of policy areas, from climate change through to education, health and hospitals and so on. And underpinning that has been reform of federal-state financial relations and an agenda aimed at delivering better services to the Australian community, enhancing sustainability and also addressing social inclusion and closing the gap in Indigenous disadvantage. So these reforms are in place. They will take time to click in, but they are fundamental to enhancing our productive capacity and productivity. And of course, as you know, we are also undertaking a comprehensive review of state and federal taxes. The Henry Review will consider measures to harmonise and simplify taxes, reduce inefficient taxes, ensure a progressive system, and address negative interactions between the tax and transfer payment systems. And on top of that, we've had fundamental reform of the pension system to ensure that the aged pension system remains sustainable over the long term, particularly given the challenges of an ageing population that I mentioned before, and ensuring that spending is focused where it is needed most. And of course, to boost participation, we've taken the historic decision to implement a paid parental leave scheme. And of course, on top of this, all of our efforts in climate change, which will all play a very important role in making our economy more productive into the future. We've got something like a $4.5 billion investment in a new clean energy initiative designed to assist Australia's transition to a low pollution economy, which will improve our competitiveness and help us to create jobs of the future. There's also energy market reform and, of course, a whole host of other regulatory reforms, which I know that colleagues will be talking to you about as we go through your program today. Now, underlining this is our commitment to fiscal sustainability. It's absolutely essential to macroeconomic stability, reducing economic vulnerabilities and improving economic performance for the long term. We will return the budget to surplus by allowing the level of tax receipts to recover naturally as the economy strengthens, and we'll hold real growth in spending to 2% per annum once economic growth is above trend. We have a commitment to a very firm medium-term fiscal framework, which is absolutely important to our long-term prosperity. So all of these are elements that make up a comprehensive reform agenda. But of course, our ability to achieve ambitious reforms means that we must take the people with us. So it does go to an assessment of how we as a community can work together, how we can band together to cope with these challenges and to put in place these essential reforms. I think we have seen in the Australian community over the last 25 years a remarkable capacity to adapt to change, to thrive and to prosper from it. We've seen it in the reception of the courageous reforms of the 80s and the early 90s, and I think we've seen in recent months the capacity our people do have to work together in the face of very formidable challenges. So I think that there is much that we can do as a community together if we have a unity of purpose and lock in behind this essential agenda. I myself have been incredibly heartened by the community's willingness to involve themselves in a discussion about the circumstances we currently face. I've lost count of the number of times as I've moved around the community where people have engaged me in detailed discussions about what is going on, not just here, but around the world. It shows to me that there is a capacity for change, there is a capacity for people to work together and to appreciate the enormity of the challenges that we face. And that gives me great heart as we move forward, because I think it will be important as we go through the years ahead that we involve the community, that we pull together behind a comprehensive reform agenda that strengthens our hand, that builds on our resilience as a country, so that when we are faced with similar challenges in the future, we will be a more prosperous, a more modern and a more competitive economy and in an even better position to deal with it. Thank you.
It's now, we have about 20 minutes in which the Treasurer will kind of take some questions.
One, Gary Sleeve from, Gary Sleeve from the Pilbara Regional Development Authority, which is now called PAC, which is now called PIC. I'm not quite sure where we are at this point in time with those authorities. Look, you mentioned, you made three comments there. One is a long-term policy settings, when growth returns, a low pollution economy. And, of course, the big variable would appear to be the climate change, which is another way of coming behind this global financial crisis. I think the question I'd like to ask is that how much change will the average Australian have to undertake to adapt and survive in a low pollution economy?
Well, certainly it's it is a big challenge, and it's very important for Australia that we put in place the carbon pollution reduction scheme and the associated renewable energy target to make sure that we maximise the opportunities that will flow from a lower pollution future, not just here but around the globe. There are tremendous opportunities for Australia when it comes to investment in renewable energy, for example, and there are tremendous challenges we face if we don't put our own economy on a much more sustainable footing, because one way or the other, the world is moving to a more carbon-constrained future by a variety of international agreements that are coming down the track. And we think it's important that we get in early so that, one, we can minimise the costs of adjustment to this economy if we move early, and secondly, maximise the opportunities that flow when the rest of the world really starts to move through in the implementation of their plans. So, for example, if you look at the modelling that the Treasury put out there, which underpins both the Green Paper and the White Paper, you can see that there are many industries in this country, particularly, or some of them, particularly even in the mining sector, which will continue to grow strongly even in a carbon-constrained future. That's set out very clearly in the modelling. So the government's approach is we've got to recognise the reality of the situation we're faced with. So we did delay the start of the scheme by 1 year. We've moved to a fixed price for 1 year. But we know, and what the business community says to us as well, is that if we can provide a framework early, if we can provide certainty for that framework early, investment will certainly flow to where it's needed, and it will position us to gain the advantages that will flow from the globe acting collectively over time to deal with carbon pollution. So we think that an early move is very important for this country to set ourselves up for that environment that is coming down the track, to deal on the one hand with the environmental consequences of dangerous climate change, but to maximise on the other the economic opportunities that will flow to those countries that deal with this in a way that is most effective. And of course we believe putting a price signal in the system via a carbon pollution reduction scheme is the most effective market orientated way of dealing with the challenge.
John Hepburn from Greenpeace Australia Pacific. Mr Swan, I'd like to acknowledge the solar flagship announcement. It's a very welcome step forward in promoting renewable energy in the budget, and our assessment was that in the budget there was still roughly $7 billion going towards promoting the use of fossil fuels. And if you look at the ratio of subsidies to fossil fuels compared to renewables, it's still 9-1. I'm just wondering if you could speak to that and how we get to that balance where we're giving more support to renewables than fossil fuels.
Well, I don't accept the figures that underpin your question. I don't think that the imbalance is anything like that. We are a major producer and exporter of fossil fuels, which delivers a very significant economic benefit to this country. Some of those fossil fuels are ones that your organisation, I know, is particularly hostile to. But the truth of the matter is simply this, that when it comes to coal, for example, the world will still be very substantially dependent upon coal as we go through the next 40 or 50 years. What we've got to do is make sure that we clean it up as best as we possibly can. The Stern Report makes that very clear. So we're committed to putting a lot of energy, effort and money into facilitating and pushing along the research and innovation in the area of clean coal, something that Martin Albrecht knows a lot about, because he's not only involved in that area, but he's also very involved in the renewable energy area and very involved with geothermal. So we have to do both. We've got to clean up and put as much investment as we possibly can into our coal industry, to make sure it's got a future which is compatible with the objectives that I outlined earlier. We've got to put a lot of incentives in place to encourage investment in renewable energy, whether it's geothermal, wind, or whatever. And there's a very, very big fund in the budget for that. I don't think there's ever been an emphasis on renewable energy in this country's history like the emphasis that we've had in our last budget. We've recognised we have to move that way, but the principal drivers of driving investment, apart from what we can provide up front to assist with research and development, is the price signals that flow from first of all, the carbon pollution reduction scheme, and secondly, the renewable energy target.
Yes, good morning, Treasurer. My name's David Stewart-Watt from Parsons Brinckerhofer Engineering Consultants. Thank you for your time this morning, and congratulations to you and your government for the investment in economic infrastructure in Australia. It's definitely well needed. The one thing that the industry does get concerned about is that we welcome the high level of investment you're putting in now, but it's the roller coaster ride of government investment that hurts industry. We saw that with the Olympics in Sydney, where after the Olympics we saw a lot of people leave our industry because of the downturn. You're talking about reform going forward. Do you see an underpinning, a sort of a minimum level of investment in economic infrastructure going forward?
Well, of course, the capacity that we've got to directly invest will be, to a very significant extent, dependent upon the sort of conditions we're facing out in the future. But we have put in place, I think, a very significant down payment in the area of critical economic infrastructure via our investment funds. But we recognise that the infrastructure deficit in this country that has been left to us over 12 years of neglect is substantial. And what it does require now, and will require well into the future, is a partnership between government on the one hand and private investors on the other. And that's why the whole regulatory framework is important. It's why the planning framework is important. We've got to make sure that Australia is a good place to invest and that infrastructure is attractive to invest in. And that means we've got to get the underpinnings of the economy right, and that's why the government has got so much emphasis upon what I call a productivity agenda. But essentially it's going to be a partnership as we go forward between government investment on the one hand and private investment on the other, because both are required given the huge infrastructure deficit the country's been left with.
Glenn Withers, University of Australia Treasurer. As one of the sort of 21 economists' signatories to a recent financial review piece that...
It's a very good piece.
..that broadly supported the strategy of the government for economic recovery, overall that indicates strong support for the broad strategy. But there are some particular aspects that do puzzle me a little, and it'd be interesting to get your comment. One was, for instance, in the initial stimulus packages, the unemployed and the students didn't get the same sort of priority that, for instance, other income support recipients did, and that would seem to be a little inconsistent with what I would have thought would be Labor emphasis in its policies. Equally, more recently, in the recent budget, for instance, the Education Investment Fund, and I was very pleased to hear your emphasis on human capital formation, was raided by $2.5 billion to support the clean energy initiatives. I would have thought good economics would indicate that should come from public consumption rather than switch between knowledge investment into sustainable energy investment. No problem with the clean energy initiative, but I would have thought the funding would have more sensibly come from a different source.
Well, I don't accept the characterisation of what occurred with the Education Investment Fund. There's a very fine line between innovation and research, and I don't think you could seriously argue that the money we're putting into renewable energy isn't money going into innovation and research. We'd probably just too narrowly cast the mandate of the Education Investment Fund. I don't think you can seriously argue that it's not justified in coming out of that fund. I think it is. It's simply a question of priority, and we've got to move on all fronts, and there's at the end of the day only a limited amount of money. In terms of the stimulus packages, we decided to put the maximum amount of emphasis upon direct economic stimulus, and we did that in the ways in which I described earlier, cash to people who are likely to spend, and there was a payment to those that were unemployed, and there was also payments to people in education. It's not true to say that there were no payments there at all, but our priority when it comes to the unemployed is to actually get them into work. We dealt with the pension issue because the age pension is a permanent payment where people are permanently. You can't compare an unemployment benefit on the one hand to a lifelong payment on the other, namely an age pension or, for that matter, a disability support pension. I acknowledge it was a tough decision, but we decided to go for payments most directly to get people into work in the first instance, and that was our priority.
Jim Longley, Commonwealth Bank. Treasurer, I'd like to ask a question about interest rates in the medium to long term, whilst I'm hesitant to ask about any of that given the particular time.
Wise.
Definitely the medium and longer term is the basis of the question, and understanding that you're limited in the sorts of comments you can make in that arena anyway. Given the government's projections about economic growth coming out of the recession, projecting quite strong growth, but those same projections are also indicating the government is going to be running a deficit for some time into that. Just interested in your thoughts and comments about the potential pressure that will put via the government borrowing requirement on interest rates and the overall economic demands at that time. Thank you.
Well, there's been a fair bit of debate about our forecasts. I think it's fair to say that we regard our forecasts as being relatively conservative. There's been now, the public debate has swung from them being too conservative to now to being not optimistic enough. We think we've been very realistic in our forecasts. Yes, we do have to borrow to make up for the collapse, the very substantial collapse in revenues, $210 billion. Over the Ford estimates. What's the alternative to borrowing? Well, the alternative to borrowing is either savagely jacking up taxes to make up for that revenue loss or savagely cutting services. Both of those actions would prolong and deepen the recession, increase the number of unemployed and increase the length of the longer-term unemployed, having dramatic financial impacts upon the deficit and the outlook way out. So what I'm really saying is that the action we've taken to borrow responsibly is one that's kept deficits lower than they otherwise would be, borrowings lower than they otherwise would be, because the responsible thing to do in this environment is to borrow when you're faced with a sharp contraction, the nature of which has been imposed on this country by the rest of the world, and a dramatic fall in business investment. So we think our growth forecasts are realistic. And if we exceed them, well, that would be a good thing, but we shouldn't forget that this global recession has got some way to run. And the big challenges for Australia out there relate particularly to the reduction in private business investment as a consequence of the global recession. That's why we've had to move so strongly with such strong economic stimulus. The huge hit to our terms of trade that flows from the dramatic reduction in commodity prices, which is having a savage impact on our national income. Those two things have got some way to play through in our economy, and that's why we will be facing higher unemployment as we go through the rest of this global recession. But we as a country have the capacity to service our debt. Our debt is absolutely modest by any international standard, lower than any other advanced economy in the world, and at its peak still dramatically lower than any other advanced economy in the world. But we are committed, as I said in my remarks earlier, to a medium-term fiscal strategy, bringing the budget back to surplus as quickly as we possibly can, and as Lindsay Tanner will tell you when he's down here with you later on, imposing a pretty savage cap on growth and new spending as growth returns to trend of 2%. So we have a commitment to quite a strong and firm medium-term fiscal strategy which will bring us back to surplus and enable us over time to pay down the debt.
Treasurer Nostiaga, Department of Innovation. I just wanted to ask whether at any stage you considered a reduction in the GST, like they've done in the UK, broad-based tax, immediate boost to consumption?
No, we believe that the measures we've put in place are the most effective that can be put in place to boost consumption. And I think there's a great deal of evidence now supporting that in terms of the outcomes that we've received. Over a month ago, the OECD did an analysis of the various forms of stimulus that have been put in place around the world. They looked at our balance between cash payments on the one hand and direct investment on the other, and concluded that ours was probably the most effective of any in operation anywhere around the world. That is much more effective than what had been put in place in Britain.
Michael Porter, Cedar Research. Treasurer, I think that the spend early and do the details later has, I think, got the support of most economists. We're also very pleased that the Australian economic reputation is fantastic within world capital markets, and the problem came from world capital markets. My question is, in stage three of this process, aren't we advised to sort of think very carefully? I'm thinking about broadband, for example, before we spend. If we know there are private sector solutions, if we know there's unused infrastructure in every street in Australia, why are we going to force fibre down those streets? Why are we going, in the case of water, don't we again want to bring the private sector in early? So is not the time now, in stage three, to focus on our international asset position so that Australia will continue to be a preferred habitat for world capital, since it's world capital that is what's been really scarce for most key economies?
Well, certainly I'm very focused on stage three. I'm also focused on our international standing and our attractiveness as a place to invest. And as a consequence of the global recession, the government spends a lot of time talking to international investors. And indeed, I've made two overseas trips talking to international investors about how attractive a place Australia is to invest, and why now is particularly the time for international investors to invest here. And indeed, it is heartening, despite all of the challenges we've got in the international investment climate, that there are very big companies around the world continuing their investment plans in this country virtually unaffected by global events, because they have long lead times in terms of their investments and understand that now is a very good time to invest in a country like Australia, particularly in our mineral resources. So the government has a strong emphasis on that. When it comes to the NBN, the government has made it very clear that we want to attract private capital into the NBN. Absolutely. The purpose of the implementation study that we are putting in place will identify precisely how that can happen and how quickly it should happen, because we understand that that attracting capital to such a vital investment is important. But if we don't get the regulatory framework right first, we'll just end up back in the same place that we've been for the last 20 or 30 years. So we've got to get all of those things right. The right regulatory environment, we've got to get the regulatory environment out there before we get the business investment. The business investment won't come until we get the regulatory environment that is required. But we are certainly encouraging the private sector to look at ways in which they can participate in NBN. We made this very clear when we made the announcement on day one.
Brian Negus, RACV, a Victoria Treasurer. Thank you very much for your address this morning. You mentioned the Ken Henry review as part of the reform of Commonwealth-State relations, and RACV, along with all the automobile clubs in Australia, have proposed that review the implementation of road user charging in place of excise, and that would cover infrastructure costs, environmental charges, and also congestion in cities. And importantly, the revenue would need to be dedicated to actually fix the problems, not just on roads, but on public transport and in climate change. I'm interested in your take on that particular proposal and how that might wash forward in the Ken Henry review.
Well, anything I said about that would then be seen as preempting the Henry review. So I'm not going to do that. I mean, the Henry review is a serious look at the tax system, the personal taxation system, the business taxation system. It's focusing upon international competitiveness as one of its key goals, simplicity, and of course reward for effort. And there have been an incredibly wide range of submissions to Henry covering all elements of the tax system, and I've made it my practice not to buy into any of them. There's only one exclusion or two exclusions we've put in place in terms of Henry. We said we're not going to raise the GST, which I see has been put on the agenda today by one of our major business organisations. That aside, and one other exclusion, it is a genuine root and branch review of the tax system, and I await its final report at the end of the year with interest.